Whatever. I'm Helen King.
And I'm Belinda Tran Lawrence.
And you're listening to The C Word. So welcome to our first episode. If you've tuned in and wondering what The C Word is, this is a show about life after a cancer diagnosis. Cancer being one of the biggest killers of Kiwis, most people have a friend or relative that has had some form of cancer, and is what brought Belinda and I together when we were both diagnosed with the same type of HER2-positive breast cancer in 2018.
Helen, I contacted you after I saw your story published on Stuff, didn't I? And it's hard to remember timelines now, but I had been diagnosed not that long previously and started going through my journey. I think I was in chemotherapy at the time, and I saw this photo in this big double-page article that showed this amazing, strong woman, and I didn't have anyone in my life who I knew had breast cancer or really was going through anything similar and was feeling very isolated, and came across this article and got very excited, as you do, and went, oh, look, there are other people like that out there. And then, as I do, because I'm that kind of a person, I decided to stalk you on the Facebook. And I think I sent you this message like, I know this is really, really weird, but do you mind? And you very kindly did not treat me like a stalker, and you replied, so that's how we met.
Yes, that is very true. And I remember when you messaged, and I kind of felt like I clicked with you quite quickly, because I just really connected with the things that you had experienced and what you were talking about. Because I think when that story was published, I just finished my radiation treatment, and I was still having Herceptin, but I was still feeling a lot of those things of feeling like I was kind of isolated. I just felt so exhausted from the treatment I'd had, and just really didn't know, I just didn't know how to pick up my life after all of that happened. So it was, I think, one of the best things to come out of, you know, sharing my story in that way has been meeting people like yourself and other women who have gone, yeah, that's exactly what it was like for me having breast cancer and going through treatment.
And what I love so much about first your article and then talking to you is not only was I feeling really isolated, but I was just feeling a complete disjunct between what I was feeling and experiencing, because I was in chemo at that stage and chemo was hitting me really, really hard. And what I saw portrayed as women with breast cancer, and I was going through quite a bit of guilt at that time. My oncologist had said, oh, you know, you'll be fine in chemo, it'll be fine, and it wasn't fine. And all the imagery that I was seeing and all the resources that are given to you that are in support and that kind of thing, they all seem to be fine. You know, they're all pink and cheerful and wandering off into the sunset. And that wasn't my reality. It was much more messy and lonely and scary. And, of course, there's anger and there's all sorts of things going on. And in the article, you did portray quite a few of those things. And then when I got in touch with you, it was like, oh, actually, you know, it is chilly, and I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say that word. But this is the reality of it, and we can talk about it. And I did, that made so much of a difference to me.
Yeah, and I relate to what you were saying there, that and this has been one of my bugbears as someone who's had breast cancer, is that idea that it's pink and lovely because it's breasts. And I know someone has said to me that they've heard it described as you know, the nice cancer or the friendly cancer, and that has always annoyed me, because when I came out the other end of the, you know, my major treatment, I felt like I'd just walked through a fire. And I mean, I was bald and bloated and, you know, hot from menopause, and I just felt like I just didn't know what was going on.
And that is the reality, isn't it? And I think that that's why I love the idea of this radio show and podcast when you came up with it. It's like we can talk about what the reality of cancer is like for us, because it is different for everybody.
Mm.
But while it is different for everybody, it is also hard and difficult and life-changing for everybody. Like, I haven't talked to a single person who's gone, oh, you know, it wasn't that much of a big deal. It was fine.
Yeah.
It's just, even if you possibly have an easier time of it, even if it doesn't impact you physically quite to the same extent, you want to change through it. And breast cancer, as we know, it does change your physical appearance a lot. There are lots of physical impacts of the treatment. But also it changes us mentally, and it changes how we think about ourselves, how we think about others, how we relate to the world. And I love the idea that we can explore some of that in here.
Yeah, me too. Our show wouldn't be possible without our sponsor, Cares Charitable Trust. And we should mention them now because they're the people who brought us here. But also, today we're going to be talking to the woman behind the trust, Kylie Tolman. And one of the things that I love about Kylie and Cares is that it really relates to what Belinda and I have been talking about, is that idea that actually, once the treatment ends, then what? And a lot of people really experience it but don't talk about it, that actually life after a cancer diagnosis can be lonely and confusing and very, very different. And so that's what we're hoping to do in these episodes, is to, you know, really talk about that real stuff. I mean, life is very different after cancer, and, you know, I've said to people before, there is before cancer and there's after cancer, and after cancer can look quite different for people, but often there is this sort of familiar thread going through each other's lives where you're just sort of scrambling around not knowing, you know, how to rebuild. So thankfully we've got Kylie on board with Cares, and it means that we can bring this show to you.
And when people talk about cancer, you know, we do want to talk in this show about, we want to talk about the difficult stuff and the challenges and the impacts that it has on people. But quite often, as people who have experienced cancer, when we talk about it with other people, we tend to focus on the positives. We use phrases like the silver lining, and that can definitely give an idea to people that, you know, heck, cancer was the best thing that ever happened to me. And of course it's not. Like, nobody wishes it on anyone. I did, interestingly, meet a woman at a dinner party once who, when she found out I had been not long diagnosed, she said to me, oh, it's going to be the best thing that ever happened to you. And I have often wondered if she actually woke up in the middle of the night after she went home and went, oh my goodness, did I do
that? Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I know. Yes, people do say things like that.
I know. I think we could dedicate a whole show to the dumb things people say to you when you've had cancer.
I think it's a really good idea. What not to say to someone who has cancer?
There are so many.
To do that. But I think maybe this is also a time to say that through the show we will also touch on some of those, for want of a better way of saying it, the positive things as well. Because, you know, we aren't changed, and there's a lot of changes that go on at this time. And because we're human, we do also want to find the good stuff in there too. And while I can't obviously speak for anybody else, for me there has been changes that I know in later life I will look back on and go, I'm pleased I have developed in those ways. It has prompted me to look at life in a different way. And when I'm further down the track, I know I'm going to look back on that and go, I'm pleased that I had that kick in the pants.
Mm.
Okay, it was cancer, and I'm not saying I'm pleased that I had cancer, but I'm pleased that something shoved me into making this change or looking at this a different way or developing as a person in that way.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I'm not glad I had cancer, but there are things about my life now, and there's things about my outlook that I think I'm kind of grateful for. And I think part of it is that you just get very focused on what you want out of life. You know, it's, you sort of have to cut out the BS, because it's all, almost like that shake of actually life's really short and, you know, what do you want to focus on? So I think, yeah, I like that, that there are actually some positives in this sort of awful messiness that is a cancer diagnosis.
Yeah, the awful messiness. Maybe we should rename the show The Awful Messiness. That'll be a good name.
Yeah, The Awful Messiness of Cancer. I do want to point out as well that Belinda and I have actually never met in real life. So we've met over Facebook Messenger and we've met over Zoom meetings, but we've never actually met in real life.
So, I'm pretty sure that we like each other.
Yeah. It's one of those, I think it is actually one of those cool things when you've had this sort of shared experience, but also I feel quite drawn to people who have that similar outlook of, you know, social justice and wanting to explore identity and that sort of thing. So there's another positive, is that sometimes these, you know, these very difficult things often bring in people in our lives that are actually, you know, pretty awesome.
Well, I'll take that title as pretty awesome. I will also confer that title on you. Helen, you can be pretty awesome too.
Sometimes.
On our tangent of pretty awesome, perhaps we should go back to Kylie now.
Yes, we should.
Okay, so Kylie was 13 when she was diagnosed with triple negative breast cancer. And as those who know anything about breast cancer know, it's less common in people who are younger. But it does definitely still happen, and the fact that it is less common means lots of young women don't necessarily realise that they are also at risk. And triple negative breast cancer is a particularly rare and aggressive form of the disease. Once treatment had ended, she thought, like a lot of us do, that life would go back to normal, and it's something that is often talked about and said to us while we're going through our cancer journeys, is that, oh, you'll be back to normal before you know it. But we seem to all discover that that really isn't the case. And Kylie founded CARES to help people who have finished their cancer treatment to navigate the really challenging time that often happens while they're finding their new normal.
And welcome to the show, Kylie.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Oh, lovely to have you here.
Hi, Kylie. I hope it's not too cold in Christchurch today. And thanks for coming on the show. Do you want to start by telling us what it was like those first couple of years after treatment finished?
Yeah, sure. It is quite cold though here today. So, rugged up nice and warm. So, first couple of years after treatment, I was really confused. I was angry, I was frustrated, and I didn't quite understand what was going on. I thought I was being a bit ungrateful, having got through all of this treatment and then not having this gratitude and being super happy like I thought I would have, like you see in the movies. But no, it was quite an emotional journey.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I kind of feel as well that, and I was actually saying this to someone the other day, that, I mean, cancer treatment, well, for me it was brutal. It was a really, really full-on experience. But the most challenging element of it has actually been the afterwards. And I'm 2 years out from my diagnosis, and I still don't feel like my life has come back together. I don't actually know whether I have a new normal or what that is.
Yeah, and those first couple of years, I mean, to be honest, for me it was longer, and everyone's different. It was really different back then. Being, I was diagnosed 12 years ago, there wasn't the podcast, there wasn't social media, there wasn't everything, all the great networks around, but during treatment, so even during the treatment, I felt very alone as a 30-year-old going to the Cancer Society support groups and being surrounded with a lot of older women. I felt very lonely anyway. So for me, after treatment was even harder because I felt even more alone, and I thought there was something wrong with me. I didn't realise, because it hadn't been talked about enough, that those emotions are normal and it's not unusual. And so I was thinking, oh, there's something wrong with me, really suffering quite a bit of on an emotional roller coaster. Also being in Christchurch, somewhere in amongst all that journey, can't quite remember where, it's a bit of brain fog there. We also had the earthquakes to contend with. So there was so much emotion. So for me, it was definitely probably more like around 4 years down the track that started realising that I needed to work on myself and that it wasn't normal.
Mm. You've had quite a complicated journey, haven't you, Kylie? Did you want to, like, briefly tell us about some of that?
Yeah, I was diagnosed with triple negative, which is a little bit more rare type, and was only 30 at the time, which unfortunately now young women are being diagnosed all this, you know, a lot more commonly. But 12 years ago, it wasn't really talked about, or there wasn't the networks around to see that. So yeah, went through a process of having a mastectomy on my left side, and because of being young, before they would start the chemo, they wanted to do a round of IVF and embryo egg collection to store as embryos. So that itself, we had one shot before chemo started. I ended up with overstimulated ovaries, which normally they would have bought their IVF session, but because chemo had to start, they had to carry it on, and I was very sick from that too. Ended up with a whole pile of eggs. I can't even remember the number. It was hideous.
It doesn't sound like fun.
No. And then obviously chemo, and I was fortunate not to need radiotherapy, because we had lots of clear margins. I had 18 lymph nodes out, so it was definitely lots of clear results there. But because of the type of cancer being quite aggressive and rare, and I was stage 3, it was a really aggressive course of chemo that I had to have. After that, I started my reconstruction. I had implants put in. At the time, I didn't have any other options because I didn't have enough fat to take from other areas or anything like that. Like, I'm such a small frame. So, and being young, I didn't really get any other options. I just kind of went with the flow. But like, as we do with cancer treatment, step by step, you're going through the motions. You're moving from one process to another.
We've talked previously, Kylie, about how you felt like you didn't really have the knowledge to navigate the system at that point. So you were really just going along with what was suggested to you, and maybe all the options weren't clearly outlined to you.
Yes, definitely. Yep. Because I was young, everyone just assumed I'd have recon. And I mean, at the time, I just went with the flow, and I didn't question it. I didn't question, I guess, as well, I'd been through so much, I wanted to feel and be normal again. So for me, having breasts again was my way of just moving on and being normal. But yeah, it was an interesting journey. I found 8 years later that one of my implants had ruptured, and then when I went for the scan, they realised that both had ruptured, so I don't know how long for. At that point, I chose not to get them replaced. I wasn't feeling that well myself, and I learned a lot more about silicon implants. Mm. And there had been a lot of stuff in the media around the time of the ones that were causing the ALCL cancer, which is the non-Hodgkin lymphoma cancer that some of the silicon implants were causing, and the type I had was those exact ones.
Oh, wow.
So once I learned that, I was like, no, I'm not getting them replaced. I'm not putting my body at more risk. And I also didn't want to have to keep having them redone every 10 years, which is what I had been told. So, yeah, a bit of a no-brainer. I guess been a bit older and having done a lot of work on my mindset, on myself, and a lot of self-love and accepting what I've been through, I didn't feel I needed them anymore.
Wow. It must be, and I know both of you now are part of the No Titty Club. I'm part of the One Titty Club. Sorry, I know. I'm just thinking, what do I call this? But I planned it. You know, that decision's so interesting.
And fabulous. I've never heard it called the No Titty Club.
The No Titty Club.
You should trademark that name, definitely.
Yeah, I'm the One Titty Club. It is such an interesting decision, isn't it? And because I wasn't offered reconstruction straight away because of the size of my breasts. Silicone wasn't going to work, and because my BMI was higher, the type of reconstruction would have made it a huge surgery. And I don't know that I will have reconstruction, but I really admire, you know, both of you for choosing. Actually, no, I'll have none, because it is, I think, our breasts are so linked. As much as we, you know, can try and sort of detach from it, they are really linked to femininity.
It's interesting you should say that, though, because I've had other people say to me, oh, you're so brave, I admire you so much for choosing not to have a reconstruction. And there's always a part of me that goes, really? Because actually I'm just taking the lazy way out here. I can't even comprehend going through another surgery.
No.
I'm just doing it because it's the easiest thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah. What was the surgeon's response when you said, no, actually, I don't think I will have a reconstruction, Kylie?
Oh, that was interesting. Yeah, she wasn't buying it. I had to really convince her. She wanted to leave the skin saving, do the skin saving surgery.
Yeah.
And leave the dog ears.
Oh, yes.
Which I was like, no way. I had to really convince her to take the whole lot and have the whole lot gone and leave a really nice tidy scar. She was certain that I would change my mind later.
Wow, that's really interesting. And did you have the same experience, Belinda, when you had, because you had a second breast removed earlier this year?
Yeah, I did. I had chemo first, and then I had a mastectomy on the left side, so similar to Kylie. And then, and I wanted to get them both done at that point, and the surgeon convinced me to hold off. He wasn't happy doing both of them at that point, because I just had chemo, really, more than for any other reason. He said come back to him in a few months if I was determined. And it was a hard decision to make. You know, as much as I thought it would have been an easy one to make in terms of the kind of person I am, what I value, where I am in my life stage, all of that kind of thing, it was difficult. And these things, I think, always are harder than we think they're going to be. And they're always more complicated and complex than we think they're going to be. But I did, in the end, I was happy to have that time. And like, looking back, I'm still really happy I had that time to sit with what it was like having one breast. Mm. I found that I did not want to wear a prosthesis, not at all, not even, not under any circumstances. I did have some interesting conversations with people about that, even my mother, and I'm sure my mother will listen to this, but I'm sure she also won't mind me saying this, but she would keep saying, well, but the clothes would fit better if you were wearing a prosthesis. And I'm like, yes, but maybe the clothes should fit me instead of me having to fit the clothes.
Yes, yes.
So, yeah, like, I mean, I sat in that interesting space for almost a year and then said, no, actually, this just doesn't feel like me. I would like to get another one on. And I guess I was a bit older than Kylie, a good bit older, so I didn't possibly have quite so much to push back. I had three children. I was pretty determined. So yes, I did get a little bit of, oh, but you'll probably change your mind. Oh, but you're still so young. I was 43 when I was diagnosed. But you're still so young, so you'll want to get a reconstruction. You'd be happier that way. I didn't like the idea of someone else telling me what would or would not make me happy. Mm. So I just kept pushing, and in the end, there was an acceptance of that. And none of it's easy. You know, people who say, oh, you know, I'm so happy I'm flat now. And yes, I am. Absolutely, undoubtedly, I'm pleased I made the decision I made. But that doesn't mean that it's easy.
Do you... Yeah, is it similar for you, Kylie? Has it been a process of kind of sort of accepting the change in your body?
No, I was looking forward to being flat.
Wow,
I
yeah.
don't use any prosthesis and I love being flat.
Wow.
A lot of acceptance around my body image, I guess, now.
Yeah.
And I rock bikinis and I don't care what anybody thinks. But it took a lot of work on my mindset to get me there, I think. Definitely because it's quite a bit further down the track. And I maybe because I tried the implants and they didn't work for me. And yeah, I don't know. But I did, I was in the 120 Club for 2 years.
Thank you.
I'm a bit OCD, well, not OCD, but I like the symmetry.
Yeah.
And I didn't, you know, so now that, as long as I'm even, I don't actually care whether it's, you know, none, whatever. I'm even and I'm comfortable with it. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I was thinking as you're talking, you know, about cares and how it came to be. And I know that you started looking into it at the beginning of last year and then sort of made it official. What was really the catalyst for creating the foundation? Because I know you've talked about, we've all talked about that difficulty after the diagnosis, but was there something that really made you go, actually, I want to start something to help people?
I actually just probably, well before CARES started, probably a couple of years before that, I started actually talking and sharing my story a little bit more and being a bit more verbal about what I've been through because I had kept it quite hidden. Mm. And so once I started actually talking about it more, I was surprised how many people were coming to me and with similar sort of feelings and and asking me what did I do to get through that stage, and it really got me thinking. So I went and did my life coaching certification, and I thought maybe that's the way that I could help coach people through those stages. And I guess it kind of just evolved from there. I realised there was a real big need for this.
Mm.
And if it was just me coaching, I can only help so many people. It's really quite a limit to how many people I just me personally can help. So then it kind of went from there to the idea of it being a charity and having resources and having more tools and having networks of people that could possibly help. And it kind of just evolved from there. Early last year, it was an idea that just popped into my head and I was like, actually, that could really work.
Yeah. But I know it's really hard work doing this stuff, and I take my hat off to you because you've been one powerhouse of a woman kind of trying to plug along with it. What are some of the challenges that you've come across?
Crazier maybe I am. I don't know. It definitely has its ups and downs. Sometimes just all the stuff that we need to do, all the policies and procedures, you know, all the background work and getting a charitable organisation set up. It's a lot more than what I realised.
Yeah.
But I get messages from people saying that the support group that we run or the things that we're doing is helping them or how much it's needed, and people reaching out, and it just pushes me on. It really does. And some days are hard and some days are easy. And then I meet incredible people who are also passionate about the same thing and want to help. And I'm like, awesome, that's cool, let's do it. Like this.
Yeah, yeah. Because I think we've touched...
I just thought that's a pretty cool, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is pretty awesome. And I think... because I think cancer impacts people in different ways. And I mean, I've sort of learned for myself that my experience was probably slightly different to you two because I don't have children. And so I sometimes think about, you know, how do you cope with treatment when you're, you know, trying to be a mum or a wife? I mean, I had a partner at the time, but I think it's slightly different when you've, you know, got that family dynamic. So, I mean, do you guys want to talk a little bit around motherhood and how do you navigate having cancer?
Oh,
and
that's the whole podcast.
I know, but it's just I just think it's quite interesting because I, you know, I think women tend to know how to keep pushing through, and I just wonder, you know, how do you do that during chemo, and how do you do it during the, you know, the aftermath?
I can see
Kylie
shaking her head.
We're
both looking at her. Who wants to dive in here? I think it would be fair to say our experiences will be quite different because Kylie's children were a lot younger than mine. Mm. The age of your children makes a very big difference, I think, from talking to a few women. And I think most women who are mothers, whether you have given birth to a child or in whatever way you are a mother, but most women who are mothers, that becomes probably the central part of our identity. That supersedes everything else, be it being a wife, having cancer, whatever it is. It's first and foremost. However, obviously having cancer, going through chemo, there are times when it is very difficult to not let the cancer be uppermost. My youngest, when I was diagnosed, she was still 14 at that point. Yeah, she was 14. And she was the last one we told. We didn't tell her until it was pretty obvious. It was set in stone. This is what it was. And it was funny. Her reaction was... Okay, I shouldn't say her reaction was funny. That sounds terrible, but her reaction was funny. She said, "Oh, Mum, you should be watching too many movies. Are you going to be one of those people who just, you know, you just lie in bed and you're all pale and you look ill and you can't move?" And as soon as she said that, the same image popped into my head that was obviously in hers. Because, you know, those movies where the mother just flies in. It's almost always a woman. The mother just flies in the bed. And I was like, "Of course not. Don't be silly." Well, you know, a month later when I'm in the midst of chemo, I was one of those, you know, bald and sick looking and lying in bed and with no energy. And we've had a good laugh about that on a number of occasions. But like I was saying, my kids are older, and we told them right at the beginning. I know some people choose not to tell their children for a little while. And we were pretty upfront with them. However, we didn't talk about things like, you know, we didn't talk about statistics or possible worst case, because it's pointless. There was no need. We talked about what we needed to talk about then, like, this is the next step. This is what we know. This is what we know now. This is what's happening. And because my three girls, so they are now they are 16 and 20 and 24. I had to think about that. I just had breakfast with the 24-year-old this morning. She's almost 25. And they're strong girls. Like, they really are. They're strong. They're very sure within themselves and their own identities. They have their own range of interests. They're advocates and activists in a variety of areas, and they're very, very good at getting on with things. There seems to be some kind of culture in our family where we're all great in emergencies. When there's something that needs to be done, we just do it. We don't fluff about and worry too much and get all upset and need someone else to look after us. We just do it. So the girls have been amazing For me, they've been absolutely amazing. My youngest is the only one who has been home through it all, and we possibly underestimate the impact that it has probably had on her because she's been the one at home, and she's the one who sees all the ups and downs and sees how difficult it is for me. And we've got our bedroom is upstairs, so through chemo, going up and down that stairs. Oh my gosh, I hated those stairs so much. So one time, she got a whole heap of little bits of paper, and she folded them up into these origami shapes, and she wrote quotes on them, and she put them on the stairs because I would often have to stop on the way up the stairs to like rest. So she put these all up the stairs so they were to provide me with motivation.
Oh, that's beautiful.
They were the best thing ever. My favourite one was the one that says, life is heavy, but you are heavier. Because we have a constant joke in our... I know it sounds terrible, but we have a joke in our family when I'm, like, wrestling with the kids. I'm always like, well, I can always beat you because I'm the heaviest.
Yeah.
So she took this and it's like, you can do this, Mum, because you're heavy. I had actually put on a bit of weight, so, you know, it was quite realistic. I mean, I guess I've gone a little bit away from what you originally meant in your question, Helen, but for me, motherhood and cancer actually ended up becoming quite entwined. I wasn't someone who felt that they needed to put the cancer aside to be able to parent my children, because they were older and because they were pretty emotionally strong people anyway. It all just became part of it. And I'm sure it might be interesting in the future for us to interview some children of people.
Yes, yeah.
I think from the kids' perspective, they would probably say that they found it hard because they knew that life for me was really, really difficult at that point. And being able to get on with their own life, the older two were at university, the younger ones at school, you know, being able to get on with that and have a good time and go out with their friends and be involved in a million things, I think they felt a constant guilt that they weren't at home and they weren't helping me and that they should be at home. There was lots of shoulds and that kind of thing in there. And so for older kids, I think that that was a key thing in their experience.
I wonder, Kylie, your experience must be a bit different because your son must have... Were both of your sons alive when you had cancer? Just
no,
the one?
No, my oldest was two when I was diagnosed.
Wow, and I wonder what his sort of understanding. Yeah, because I don't have kids, but I have a niece and a nephew, and I looked after my nephew a bit when I had chemo. And one day we were in the car, and what did he say to me? Well, Mum was driving, and Lucien was in the back, and he said to me, "Did you have your arm chopped off?" You know, Mum was like, "Oh, tell him." And I said, "No, I got very sick, and the doctor thought the best thing to do was to remove one of my breasts so I would get better." And he just went, "Oh." So
matter of fact.
Yeah. So, I mean, what was it like for you with a toddler? I mean, that's such an intense time for a child.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy. But again, how we dealt with it was, very much just matter of fact, but at a kid's level. He went through a lot, actually. I was one of those parents, I guess, in a way that did have to put the cancer aside and just get on and be a mum.
Yes.
In some ways for him, which I think is what actually kept me going quite a lot and just made, you know, got me getting out of bed on the days that I did find it tough because I just felt I had to keep some sense of normal for him. But I was really fortunate, actually, that we had financial support from the Cancer Society, actually, and putting him into preschool so I could actually have some time during the week to rest.
Wow.
And that was really, really valuable. It was really good. Because that was huge. But yeah, so matter of fact, I'd go to preschool and go, "Mum's got no hair and Mum's got one boob," and you know, and I'd be like, and he thought that was normal. Like, he didn't think that was anything weird. But definitely on an emotional level, it was a lot for a toddler to go through seeing Mum sick and all of that sort of stuff. And then obviously we, you know, he was 2 then. He was 4 when we lost our home to the earthquakes. When I had finished my treatment, and I was going on a bit of a depression journey myself, and the ups and downs and the highs and lows. And, you know, for a kid to be seeing that as a parent who's meant to be the strong one and the role model is probably really tough.
Yeah. Because my mum had cancer it must be 12, 13 years ago. She had endometrial cancer. And I remember her and dad turning up at my flat and just going, "Mum's got cancer." And because my parents are very matter of fact, and that's just sort of the way we communicate with each other. And I can't even really remember what else was said. But I think I cried for a day after that because it was so scary, the thought of Mum having cancer, because I think, you know, we associate cancer with death, and you know, I very attached to my mum, so it was just this like really, really scary thing when you don't know about, you know, what sort of cancer it is, what grade, what stage, and all those sorts of things. And so I imagine for a, you know, a small child, you know, they are so aware of what's going on that I can see why that would be really challenging.
Very different. Yeah. And that's the thing, like what Belinda was saying, everybody as a mother, depending on the age of the children, I guess their experience and what they're going through and what the children can understand and articulate is all different. So,
yes.
So different.
Yeah, absolutely.
As Kylie said, well, when your children are younger, you need to be their mother first and foremost before anything else. And Kylie, I imagine it was really difficult, as you touched on, trying to figure things out for yourself within the space of also being a mother, because for young children you have to be fairly unassailable as a parent, don't you? I mean, they want you to be always strong and always in control. The idea that you might not be in control of everything is extremely scary for a young child. You don't want to appear to be unsure or figuring things out or no idea what you're doing with your life.
Yeah. And I think it sort of brings us round to what CARES is about, because I guess this conversation sort of made me think that when you're in the thick of that, you know, the cancer part, the treatment part, it's kind of like the immediate emergency. And I know for myself, I'm kind of okay at responding to that really immediate stuff. But then the sort of after effect of it is quite slow, and it sort of unfurls and sort of appears in quite strange ways. And I don't think that there is enough out there that supports us through that, you know, trying to figure out, how do I get mentally prepared to work again? How do I manage this fatigue, or the grief or the sadness or those, you know, the anger and stuff, and still sort of function as a partner, as a friend, and that sort of stuff? And I really didn't know where to turn when all that stuff was happening.
And that's one of the reasons why I was really interested in the idea of this podcast when you first started talking about it, Helen, because that has very much been my experience, is that in the moment, you know, you've got that next doctor's appointment, that next surgery, that next treatment date. You've got things you're working on, and you feel safe insofar as you have a team. You're meeting with one or more of them on a regular basis. Someone is telling you what to do, when to do it, what to expect. You've got a number to call. if things don't feel right for you, and then suddenly, and it is so much more suddenly than I expected it to be, suddenly all of that safety net, that structure, that framework around you is just taken away. And there's an idea that you're supposed to be ecstatically happy at that point. My oncologist, when I said to him, what now? He's like, go off and live your life. Yes. And I'm still trying to figure out what the heck life is now.
Yeah.
And I think from the medical team, from their perspective, they think that there is a range of other support available for people when they get to that point. And depending on where you live or what your access to different services are or what you're aware of, there either isn't any or it's quite difficult to find and to assess what is pertinent to your particular situation. And there's a heck of a lot that then rests on your shoulders. You're exhausted and you're traumatized from what you've just been through for the last year or 18 months or whatever it is. Realistically, nobody's journey is really going to be shorter than a year.
No.
Is
that what you're finding, Kylie, with the people who access CARES? Is there a common sort of theme in that?
No, not really, because sometimes it can vary for everybody. And when those emotions catch up with you, because like Belinda said, you are... when you're going through treatment, you're on autopilot. You're going through the motions. And then when that stops, for some people, the enormity of what they've been through can happen instantly. And for some people, it might take a couple of years. Mm. And just one day they'll be going about their day and something will trigger them and it will just all flood back and start from there. So everybody is really different, I think, and also with all the different types of cancers and the different types of treatment out there. It is very different. But the support, there is, like Belinda said as well, there is some support out there for people depending on where they live and stuff like that. But a lot of it does tend to have quite long wait lists as well in some cases. Because the mental health system is overloaded anyway, yes, as we all know. So the wait list then to see a clinical psychologist could be quite a while. And as women, we don't normally ask for help until we're desperate. And then you ask for your help and then you've got to wait 6 months to get it.
Yeah.
And that's, in 6 months, a lot can happen to somebody's emotions. And,
yes.
It could turn dark quite quickly. And it's, CARES is all about having that support there and having just a support network of people that get it and understand and can reach out and support each other as well and just have those conversations happening. It's really important.
And isn't it funny what brings it up? Facebook is so good at reminding us of what happened last year or 2 years ago. And for me at the moment, 2 years ago I was in the process of that diagnosis and mastectomy, and I'm the same as you, Kylie. I had a fertility treatment and then bang into menopause and chemo. But this time last year, my body really took a thrashing from chemo, and I had two surgeries last year to repair things that just didn't go well from chemo side effects. And one of them was I had this tiny bit, it was kind of like the join, I guess, of an incision that never healed. And so, I guess it's at that brow line. So it was always going to be a difficult one, but then having the radiation really destroyed the tissue. And so I got my dog ears repaired, and he sort of tried to repair that. And this is probably a little gross, but it actually turned into a hole, and I am so glad I'm numb on that side because I had lymph nodes removed as well, because it just, the skin was so damaged from the radiation. And so that was one more thing to deal with, that I had this hole in the side of my body that needed I remember I ended up going to the district nurse or the public nurse, for 2 or 3 days a week to get the dressing changed. And they were, I mean, I love nurses and they were amazing. But even just the energy it took to have that, and it was one more thing that was being repaired. And that really sent me over the edge. It was just like, I can cope with everything else. But my body falling apart in the way that it did was, it just sort of was a bit too much by that point.
You had a hole in your...
I had a hole.
You told me about this. I really remember when you told me about this and that you were struggling to keep going. And I think I said something to you like, for goodness sake, go to bed, pull the covers over your head. You don't have to cope with having a hole in your body.
I know.
You're allowed to fall apart.
It really did send me over the edge because it was just like, are you kidding me? Yeah, but thankfully it is no longer. Those nurses just they fixed me up. But it, yeah, it is sort of this constant battle of repairing your body after chemotherapy, and the mental kind of stuff. Yeah, it's, I think that for me is an ongoing thing. And I don't know about you guys or other people in your networks, but I have found lockdown through COVID really triggered some of that stuff, because it was, I guess for me, you know, the cancer, you can't see it. And you, it was this thing that was threatening, you know, it's threatening you, but you have no control over it. And all of a sudden, that was COVID. It was like we were being put into lockdown. There's a threat out there. And that sort of fear and anxiety really has come back for me.
I think that kicked in for me at the beginning, when the cases first started rising in New Zealand and there first started to be discussion about, okay, what is this going to look like? It's going to be really bad. And there was a lot of fear that was starting to be elevated in everybody, really. Mm. And I had just had my second surgery, but I had my second mastectomy in the midst of that. And I found when I came home from that surgery the next day, and this is what everyone was talking about, and we were having Zoom calls with our daughters in Wellington going, what's going to happen? How are we going to... And we're saying, we think you should come home. If you don't come home now, you might not be able to. And we were trying to help them with planning. This is what you need to have in the house. And I don't think I have ever been as anxious, or yeah, up to that point. I don't think I'd ever been as anxious as I was at that time. And I was starting to get quite panicky.
Mm.
We then had a whole other medical emergency that happened that was not me, for a change, was not me. I wasn't panicked for the rest of lockdown because I had other things to focus on. Because, you know, you always focus on the thing on top, don't you?
Yes.
But, yes, I do think lockdown and the COVID crisis has had a very large impact on people who have and have had cancer.
Mm.
And I'm definitely hearing that back from my networks, that I think a lot of it is simply we've been through much and through so much and we're so tired
that, yes,
it's another thing, it's one more thing. It's always when you pile just feels like it's getting too heavy and something's, yes, gonna fall off.
And I imagine for you, Kylie, I was just thinking this, that you've been through cancer, you lived through the Christchurch quake, and now the COVID stuff. I mean, this must feel like, oh, okay, another crisis.
It's just another thing.
Yeah.
It's just another thing to deal with, yeah. Yeah, and we kind of, I guess we're kind of a bit tough down here now in Christchurch with everything, so we just take it on the chin with everything else and just get on with it. But definitely, though, for people who have had previous treatment or are still going through treatment and stuff like that, it's not been easy. Those that have had to go into self-isolation before or during, you know, during treatment to keep away from all the germs and bugs and stuff like that, then having to isolate again can be a little bit triggering.
Yes.
So we know what to do, so we've kind of been there, done that, so we're,
yes,
well armed with the tools and the knowledge. But but it can re-trigger, a bit like how you were saying, Helen, those anniversary kind of type things. It can re-trigger that, like, I've been here before, and the body and the emotions still holding on to that and the reasons why. And, yeah, so it's definitely very, very strong, I think, for a lot of people who have been through treatment.
Yeah.
Do you know one thing I really liked about it? I'm not much of a hugger, which, Helen, you don't know yet because you haven't actually met me in person. But I don't love hugging. I never have done. And, you know, as soon as you get cancer, everyone wants to hug you because you're a poor cancer victim. Therefore, even though they know you don't like hugs, you're suddenly supposed to enjoy their hugs because you're a poor cancer victim. So I like the fact that when we have that now in our new normal, people don't hug anymore, and it's not my fault anymore. They don't get to go on at me about it. It's great.
That's hilarious. I'm not much of a hugger either, and it's really funny because a couple of my closest friends aren't huggers either, and so we just fist pump. That's our little hello. How are you going?
Funny. I'll have to remember that when I ever meet you guys. Hopefully, Belinda, I might meet you soon.
Just
I won't hug.
Just a fist pump, thanks.
Honestly, I've gotten a lot better at it. I have gotten a lot better at accepting that it can be a nice form of greeting, but I just think it's interesting that now everybody is thinking about things that people who have had cancer and been through chemotherapy, we are used to thinking about that. My husband used to run interference for me and get very angry at people who insisted on hugging me when my immunity was really, really low, and they were doing it to make themselves feel better. They knew I didn't even like it anyway. So it's like most bizarre thing. He wanted to get me a t-shirt printed to not hug me.
Back off. Wow. Do you know, guys, we are at the end of our very first episode. We have managed to fill this hour with lots of different things, which is pretty amazing. But thank you so much, Kylie. It is really cool to talk to you and have your support and have the support of Cares. If people are interested in getting in touch with you, what's the best way of doing that?
Jump onto our website. So we've got our website there, www.carescharity.org.nz. You can subscribe to newsletter there. It will tell you of any upcoming events, any support groups, speaking events or workshops that are coming in the pipeline. And also there's a link in there to our closed Facebook group. The Facebook group is really awesome for the day-to-day support, and any resources and stuff like that will be fed through there. So yeah, that's the best way to do that, and over time we'll have more resources and more things that people can access as well.
Yeah, and we'd love to have you back on regularly, and we can catch up and talk about all the different things. I mean, there's never an end of things to talk about when it comes to cancer, which is both good and bad. Awesome.
Great. Yeah, definitely. And also, when we've got events coming up, to come and talk about them, and be great.
And thanks so much for coming and having a chat to us today, Kylie. Helen, do we have a cute little sign-offy thing, or are we just going to do the awkward, how do we get?
No, we do have a little sign-off. I've got thanks for listening, and thanks to Kira's Charitable Trust for sponsoring our show. And also to Marnie Harris for the title track that we're using, and that is That Day. So join us every Sunday at 11:55 a.m. on Planet FM 104.6, online at planetaudio.org.nz, or find us on Spotify and iTunes. And if you missed any of that about where to find Cares, if you're interested in finding some more support after your cancer diagnosis, visit Cares at carescharity.org.nz. Thanks so much for listening.